This webcast is a service of SDPB. More information at sd.net.
Seated. Thank you. Good morning. The first case set for argument today is appeal number 30862, CHS Capital versus Skyline Cattle Company. Daniel Brentro is present. We'll be arguing on behalf of the appellants, in this case, Skyline Cattle Company and estate of Paul O'Farrell. And Joe Erickson is present, will be arguing on behalf of Appley VOR, Inc. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Brentro, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal, and you can proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel. Well, I've sure learned a lot about civil procedure from the O'Farrell cases. My hope is that at some point it leads to resolving the underlying issues on their merits. This case involves an aspect of civil procedure interrelated with Rule 13A, compulsory counterclaim rule. Of all of the rules of civil procedure, it is the only one that I can think of that's described as one that has harsh consequences. Virtually all the other rules of civil procedure are interpreted in a way to, in a more liberal fashion. This one is designed to ensure that we only have one lawsuit for every set of related facts.
So if you want to have the cases, the claims resolved on their merits, why would you ask for relief on appeal that dismisses this cross-claim when the pre-existing claim that remains with the circuit court features now an order where VOR is not a party at all? So conceivably, if we accepted the argument that the cross-claim should be dismissed, that might be the end of that claim. It would never be determined on the merits.
You're talking about the claim that VOR has brought to collect its debt?
Yes, yeah. The cross-claim in this case.
Yeah. Meaning if you dismissed it and it's not available in the other action, that's the harsh result that Olowski talks about.
Right, but I thought you said you wanted to have all these claims adjudicated on their merits.
Yes, in one single action. The question is then, if you apply the harsh result here, I think in Olowski, in the case that follows that, they say it's not our concern what happens next. If it's brought at all, it has to be brought somewhere else. And so to the extent that this particular cross-claim is resolved elsewhere, it will be on the duty of VOR to bring it in the other action.
So if it appeared you initially asked the court in this case to stay any consideration of the claim and then also mentioned that it is a compulsory counterclaim and made those arguments together, and part of one of your issues here on appeal is to which is the appropriate remedy if we were to agree that this is already an existing claim made by Skyline in the other suit, even regardless of whether a compulsory counterclaim is or a counterclaim is raised. So does the current, and at the time you were arguing that before the circuit court, there wasn't the current ruling in the pre-existing lawsuit. So does the current ruling affect the potential or the remedy, the most appropriate remedy here? And what is your view of what is the status of VOR in the pre-existing lawsuit?
Well, so the pre-existing lawsuit, meaning 30508 Paul's original civil lawsuit, is still pending, and there are no final orders or judgments in that case. And so it still exists if this were reversed.
I understand that, but my question is, the appeal might happen, you know, who knows what will happen down the line, but the current status of it, the courts, the circuit court's order dismissed VOR as a plaintiff. I don't know, I know there had been a cross or a counterclaim alleged by VOR as aligned with defendants. Is that, and I'm just wondering what your understanding is, what is the current status of VOR based on the latest order of the circuit court in that case?
If you go back to the 30508 file and you look at the April 2023 filings, VOR, represented by the other control group, Raymond's control group, files an answer and counterclaims. So there are pending counterclaims from 2023 until today. They're still there. These counterclaims still exist.
And one of them by, or at least VOR, being someone asserting a counterclaim.
Yes.
And that still exists, is your understanding?
Absolutely, it still exists.
How could it exist if VOR is no longer a party in that underlying case?
So I think that's a misnomer, but...
Well, I read the order. Maybe it is, but tell me how it's wrong.
Yeah. It's essentially what happens in derivative lawsuits where somebody brings a claim and then a different control group says, no, you're not allowed to bring that claim. We're the company. The remedy at that point in time is to realign the parties, and then the VOR would become a defendant.
That was sought in that case on remand, and that relief was denied, if I'm reading the order correctly.
Well, I don't know that it was denied. It's functionally what happened. In April of 2023, VOR appears as a party again, ostensibly represented by Mr. Erickson's firm. So they then file pleadings, and the record is filled with VOR doing things via Mr. Erickson's law firm, including VOR filing counterclaims against Paul and Skyline. And so essentially what you have, for lack of a better version of simplifying it, is that VOR was essentially realigned as a defendant, saying Paul can't bring these claims on behalf of VOR.
So they're an unnamed party at this point.
It's a declaratory judgment action, and so they've appeared. Whether they show up in the caption is not whether they're a party or not. The caption would have to catch up to what's going on. But if they appear as a party, the declaratory judgment statutes are clear that anybody who could be affected by the relief should be added as a party. They voluntarily show up as parties. The trust, Victoria's estate, and VOR, and Raymond, and then achieve relief, achieve orders.
Fleeting, though, because the outcome of that earlier appeal was wipe the slate clean, go back to the circuit court. There's no jurisdiction for any of these orders.
Their pleading still exists, though.
Yeah, but the relief you just talked about didn't add up to anything.
Well, right, but the pleadings still exist, and they've showed up as of April of 23 and asserted counterclaims. The day that they filed the motion to amend in this case, those counterclaims existed. Those counterclaims were continuing. And in fact, there's reference to it in this court file. Judge Spears is, you know, making a ruling in the other file, and then they attach his ruling at record 115 in this case, where Judge Spears in the other case recognizes that VOR has filed a counterclaim. And so at the time that this takes place, this amendment is happening, is creating new counterclaims at the same time that they have other counterclaims in the other lawsuit.
So just, and I understand your position on that. For the sake of argument, from your perspective, if VOR, if that counterclaim no longer exists, or if VOR is no longer a party in the other suit, then would that change the request that you're making to the court to require a dismissal in the CHS lawsuit as opposed to staying that while whatever plays out in the other lawsuit plays out? If you understand my question.
I think this gets to sort of the first filed rule, or the dominant jurisdiction doctrine that they follow in Texas. We're taking this case as we find it, which is that there is another lawsuit, for sure, at the point that we're asking these questions, at the point that we've asked questions throughout the entire process. And if there is another lawsuit that embraces the subject matter and the same parties and these issues, that's the forum in which to
Is there a specific claim regarding the promissory notes that's available for resolution in the underlying file, pre-existing file?
So I had forgotten this, but as long as that complaint was, you forget all the things that are in it. But the complaint actually talks about these notes. Paragraph 46 and then footnote 1 of Paul's original complaint discusses these exact notes. At the time we drafted the complaint, we were not aware that they had acquired the notes and then we're going to attempt to recover on them.
But does it involve any claims regarding those notes?
Yes. It's part of VOR's authority, what it's doing and interacting with all this. And then the claims also relate to the footnote kind of gets into the interference part of it, that Raymond is thwarted from signing renewals on these farming notes. What they are, just to back up, these are, I think, four operating notes for a farming operation that are taken out by Skyline and then are secured by VOR and their land. And the allegations in the complaint, as well as Vicky's affidavit in the other lawsuit, all make the claim. And then paragraph 46 in this complaint and footnote 1 discuss that instead of renewing them this year like they had done in every other year, Kelly thwarts the renewal process, which then puts these notes into default, which then triggers what happens next.
And so in the other lawsuit, what's the remedy that's requested with regard to those notes? You said that they made some claim. What is it that you think that other lawsuit is asking for with respect to these notes, as opposed to just outlining the facts of what's happening amongst the parties?
I believe that in count one, unwinding various actions related to what VOR is doing would constitute that.
That confuses me. So that claim would be that the remedy that VOR is asking for, that you're asking for, is to unwind the transactions that Skyline entered into with the bank?
No, to count one of Paul's lawsuit unwinds VOR's corporate actions.
I understand. But you're not asking and have never asked for the unwinding of the loans that Skyline made, the operating loan that's at dispute here.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. The other portion of relief that relates to this is that you've got these operating loans that are secured by the farmland, and Paul is operating the farm and puts in $1 million worth of improvements into the farm, part of which I think are paid for by these loans. The land is sold. Paul is not paid for any of those. And so Paul's equitable offset is another claim that's embraced by that complaint. It's discussed specifically in there. I think it's paragraph 106. The prayer for relief asks for equitable relief. And so that would be the offset.
I just need to backtrack there a little bit, because I took your argument in this current lawsuit and your cross-claim to be asserting that the validity of VOR's assignment or the bank's assignment to VOR was invalid.
Yes.
So in response to Justice Myron's question, it's not clear to me how are you saying that is part of your argument in the pre-existing argument to declare VOR's certain actions of VOR void, or is that different? So now I'm confused about that.
So the assertion would be that the assignment was invalid because it was procured by undue influence or without corporate authority. What happens next then is that you've got UCC defenses that you can use in the manner in which the assignment was received. So you don't have to unwind the entirety of the assignment, you can assert defenses against it, I think, under UCC 3705. One of the, I think, key pieces of this is the pragmatic reasons for Rule 13A. There's four of them, if I can get to them in a minute here. There's the October 6th problem. Literally the same day that VOR files their motion to amend this complaint is the same day that Paul's civil lawsuit is appealed to this court, so they literally don't exist in the same court system at the same time. That shouldn't happen. That's fragmenting litigation. Secondly is the inconsistent results problem. If you allow this to happen, you end up with different results with different juries and different fact patterns that are presented under different discretionary rulings about evidence. Three, there's the incomplete relief problem. We could achieve relief in this case, but it doesn't apply to Grand Valley because they're not a party here. And then four, the judgment collection problem. The question is, if you affirm this and they begin collections on this $1 million judgment, and then we prevail on our equitable offset later, can you assure me that we will get our money back? You can't, because it's going to go into the hands of these people that we're alleging are unduly influencing Raymond and squandering his assets. So this inconsistent collections problem inherently prevents this court or any court from hearing this lawsuit unless it's done in its entirety.
That's my question, though. So is your position on appeal that, as things stand right now, currently, today, that VOR, as things have played out, VOR now, at this point, cannot pursue an action on these notes at all, or simply that this is the wrong case in which to do it?
The second. Yeah. The assertion is not, and if it makes it simpler, if you just pause everything, unwind this and pause any further litigation about the notes until they can all be consolidated together in one action, that would be fine. But
okay. So they can litigate it on the merits, in your view, but just not here.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think it's their right, but it's my right to have $1 million offset be litigated at the same time so that I don't have Paul's assets, Paul's estate's assets, disappearing.
So more specifically, they're not precluded in the existing lawsuit from asserting a claim to collect these?
No, and they could literally do it right now because it's not a final judgment that was just issued. It was an interlocutory order on partial summary judgment. They have counterclaims pending. Like in 20 minutes from now, Mr. Erickson could go and file a motion to amend and seek to add these. And I would have, I would be happy that that would happen, but I don't think there's any viable defense that I would be able to muster if I was opposed to that in some way.
I think he's going to be busy for the next 20 minutes.
So succinctly, what relief are you asking for from this court moving forward from here as a result of this current appeal?
Well, the two things. One, unwinding this turnover of the grain check. And then secondly, vacating the summary judgment, and whether it means staying the proceedings or dismissal. But the grain check turnover is the same problem. You have a grain check being turned over to the creditor prior to the time that they've achieved a judgment showing that they're owed money. Yes, they're a priority creditor, but they're not a judge to be shown to actually be owed money. And I don't know where that money has gone either, or whether we're going to get that back. But that never should have happened either. So either vacate summary judgment and stay the proceedings on this, and then order it to be consolidated with the other action, or just dismiss it and let Mr. Erickson do it the other way by amending his counterclaim and then vacating the order as to the turnover of the grain check.
Unless there are other questions, I think your time's up.
Thank you.
Mr. Erickson, you can proceed with your argument.
Please, the court, counsel. I'm here today representing VOR Inc. in this appeal. I have notes. I'm not sure how much I'll be able to look at them because this issue of subject matter jurisdiction and the compulsory counterclaim, I think there's law right on this issue. And based on your questions and based on Mr. Brantrow's answers, goes to the heart of it, and that's that Total Lassiter case. It's a 1993 case, and it talks about the logical relation test, and then it adds, unless the different proceedings relate to different issues or there is uncertainty as to the proper tribunal. I think based on your questions and the difficult answers that Mr. Brentwell tried to give you, There is clearly uncertainty about where this counterclaim should have taken place. And when you have that, then it should be allowed to move forward. Because in the first lawsuit, which I'm always referring to the Paul lawsuit as the first lawsuit because I think it avoids some confusion, in the first lawsuit, VOR is listed as a plaintiff. And not only listed as a plaintiff, apparently making claims as a plaintiff. And there is an appearance by VOR, but it's not an appearance as a defendant. It's an appearance to say, hey, you don't get to make an appearance on behalf of VOR, Paul, because you're no longer in control of the company. You've never owned any shares. And we ask to be dismissed as a plaintiff in this lawsuit. Or else VOR is stuck in a lawsuit where it doesn't have any claim. So the second lawsuit...
But what's the status? But then you also asserted... I get that part. But then you also asserted a counterclaim that asked for damages to VR. So, and I didn't see anything in the circuit court's most recent order in that case that referred to the counterclaim. So what's the status of the counterclaim?
And it depends on what that claim by VOR is defined as, because a counterclaim would require that there be opposing parties, a claim against an opposing party.
Well, but the claim was against Skyline, I think, and at that time Paul. Now it's Paul Estate, but it looked to me like you asserted a counterclaim saying that they interfered with VOR, kind of a similar type claim that they were alleging against some of the other parties. But so that, you know, what is the status of that?
Yeah, I'd say the status of that counterclaim, or it's a cross-claim because VOR was a plaintiff. It didn't appear as a defendant and never received a summons as required to be a defendant in relation to that complaint. So it could be defined as a cross-claim that was then dismissed when they were dismissed as a plaintiff. And if you look at it, the filing, it's an answer, it's a motion to dismiss, and then it's these claims by the trust, the estate, and VOR. But then at the end of the pleading, when it asked for its relief, it states VOR and the defendants. So VOR didn't willingly say, now we're a defendant and we're making a counterclaim. It just answered a complaint where it didn't want it to be a party to this complaint at all.
So that prompts my question. So maybe, because I'm trying to figure out whether there's anything left or whether VOR remains in that underlying lawsuit or not, and the presence of these claims, I guess, may be a loose end, but is it? Because if all of them were directed to, in other words, all of the VOR claims, cross claims, whatever they are, all of those claims against the putative derivative plaintiff VOR were focused upon interference with VOR's corporate autonomy or co-opting its identity or whatever, if they're then dismissed, which happened, VOR wins.
Yeah, VOR, in my mind, is completely out of the first lawsuit. So if this court reverses on the second lawsuit, then there, and this is the problem that I see, there is no avenue for VOR to collect under these debt instruments because VOR is completely out of the first lawsuit.
Unless that's appealed.
And it has been, I think, yesterday.
So is there some wisdom in synchronizing these lawsuits to make sure that the actions that are taken in one are done in concert with actions in the other?
I think at this point there isn't any great rationale for doing that. And I say that because in the second lawsuit, we moved for summary judgment under these different notes. These notes, there was no claim in the first lawsuit related to these notes. And the footnote that Mr. Brentrow described didn't articulate a claim. It didn't say anything about that. He didn't owe the debt. It didn't say anything about that he didn't have to pay back the debt. It just merely described the story of apparently his main claim, which is undue influence by one of the other children. So now we're left with the second lawsuit in this decision where VOR moves for summary judgment and Paul and Skyline could have put forth all their evidence in that summary judgment proceeding to create a genuine issue of material fact and had a day in court. A summary judgment proceeding allows somebody to put evidence in. I mean, that's the function of, if you have evidence, bring it forward. And they don't. They don't even respond within the framework of a summary judgment proceeding. That's noted in Judge Spears' order. And they just rely on, hey, we have this other lawsuit that's been pending that we started, and we named VOR as a plaintiff. If they wanted to preserve an appeal, they could have preserved their record by actually putting forth the evidence in this lawsuit that they say is their defense to these notes. They could have the set off and these different things that he's talked about. They could have put forth that evidence. They weren't restricted from doing so. Instead, they just referred to a complaint that had VOR as a plaintiff that they never used to motion to amend to make VOR a defendant.
So I understand that prudential argument, but how does that undermine the validity of their first filed argument?
The first file argument, and that's the Totaliciter case.
The dog track racing case.
The dog track racing case, that's easier. And in that case, you have the tax issue, and it's with the administrative agency about whether should have been a tax or not. Then you have a civil proceeding started about breach of contract. And it's clear that, hey, there's only a breach of contract if this tax should be imposed. And so you have the direct question of, there's only this claim if the administrative agency says there's that claim. So that's why there's a clear first and second.
I don't know but it wasn't just a first and second there. It's because the tax issue has to be resolved in the administrative appeal with the Department of Revenue.
Right.
So here it seems like part of the arguments that are being made, you know, there is the first filed rule, but there's even that, those cases involve a number of different factors, and some of them is which is the more appropriate suit to resolve the claim. And here I think one of the arguments that has been made are that you don't have the necessary parties in the CHS lawsuit to address the claim in the other lawsuit, just because it involves various other entities. So how do you address that?
And I appreciate you moving to the point on that case, because that's where I was going. But the issue about not having all the parties, I believe the parties to this counterclaim are only VOR and Paul and Skyline Cattle, because our counterclaim is just enforcing debt. Now, his defenses to it, that he should have an equitable set-off and so forth, they could have put those defenses and evidence to support them in the summary judgment proceeding in this case. And then he could have preserved the appeal on that record. Instead, he just pointed to the other complaint.
And this is kind of where I'm going here, too. And I understand that argument. In your appellate brief, and this was on the issue of, okay, well, what, you know, notwithstanding your argument, what would be the proper remedy? Should it be a stay? You know, if we decide there's this parallel suit or there's an existing claim, or assuming there is a related claim of some sort where each affects each other. And what you said is the result of the pending dispositive motions in the first lawsuit may require a consolidation of this matter with it if the appellants, referring to Skyline, are successful in defeating the pending matters. So you seem to be suggesting, or when you say that it may require a consolidation. And so that's why I'm kind of trying to envision how this plays out. So let's say we agree with your position, affirm summary judgment here. I guess maybe this is not the same issue here, but if we were to say that the assignment is valid, there is no equitable defenses anymore, it's done, then that's done, res judicata, nothing can ever happen with regard to the grain proceeds here, it's a done deal. or were you suggesting something else? Like, why does it then need to be consolidated? So if they prevail and goes on appeal, you know, we do none of this. We don't know. You know, it's right. Future. Then what happens? Wouldn't whatever happens in this case probably is res judicata and would cut them out from arguing their equitable defenses or set offs that have been alleged in the other lawsuit? Or how does that play out then?
I believe that the res judicata element would only be applicable as to the notes and the enforcement of the notes. It wouldn't be as to their entire claim against Kelly and the undue influence claim. They still have that claim pending in the first lawsuit. That's why it's the intermediate appeal. That note in my brief about had appellants won in the first lawsuit, then it may make sense to consolidate, was more of a, if you're not going to affirm this decision in the second lawsuit, then it makes sense to put it all back at the same level, potentially, at the trial court level. But now we're...
So you're saying the notes are probably res judicata if we affirm this, which I probably tend to agree with. If that's the case, let's say at some point in time, Paul prevails, and he's right about undue influence and all those claims that are pending out there. If that happens, is it res judicata? Is he out? Does he have any defenses at that point? Is it just...
No, he still has his remedies against the bad actors, but it's never been alleged that VOR is a bad actor or a wrongful actor. There's no claim against VOR, this corporation.
Well, I understand that, but you're backing up another claim back to the assignment to VOR.
Right. So his remedy to me, if he wins on his claims against Kelly O'Farrell, then his remedy is a money damage award against the undue influencer. I mean, there's still a legal remedy for Paul and Skyline Cattle if he were to prevail on all this.
Maybe legal, but maybe not a practical, as pointed out by opposing counsel.
I think in practicality, it would be similar to other undue influence cases, actually, because it would be a money damage award as opposed to some equitable relief. And trying to bring in different entities that have no wrongdoing related to or even alleged wrongdoing into that first lawsuit is what created this issue for the appellant and for Paul and Skyline. If they didn't try to represent VOR as a plaintiff in the first lawsuit and listed them as a defendant and served them with a complaint and we answered with counterclaims, I think you're in a lot different scenario, but that's what they chose to do. And that goes to this Staub-Skoglund case, which is part of that lineage with the Olinsky case. And it makes a point of saying plaintiffs should not be heard to complain as much as she elected out of very practical legal considerations, no doubt, to seek the relief she did. So when a plaintiff starts their lawsuit and they have apparently they're representing this VOR corporation, they're electing to make that decision. So now to come back and have this compulsory counterclaim subject matter jurisdiction argument is very difficult to respond with anything besides, well, this is how you set it up, and this is how you chose to try to prevail in the remedy you sought.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, is there any harm to VOR in terms of VOR's perspective if the determination on the cross claim in the CHS case was just stayed as opposed to dismissed? I mean, how? So then you still have a claim there. You can still pursue it and address it. We just have to wait to see how the rest plays out. So how? That doesn't seem to harm VOR. Or does
there's,
it?
There's
I don't know.
I'm
interested in your thought.
Well, there would be harm in the fact that grain proceeds have already been delivered to VOR, so I don't know what the effect of the stay would be as to those grain proceeds. And then as far as the harm, of course, you wouldn't have a judgment at all and wouldn't have the legal rights that come with obtaining that judgment, whether it's exercising on it or not. I see I ran out of time. I didn't need my notes too much, so I appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Branchrow, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Mr. Brentro, earlier you said that, you know, when we were talking about that, you know, aspect of your argument where you said, you know, Mr. Erickson could go and in 20 minutes he could have this claim pending in the other case, and you didn't foresee having any objection, or excuse me, any defenses to that. Why is it significant then in this case? You mentioned something about defenses, but what defenses are you talking about to the underlying debt, the assigned debt?
And by defenses, I meant I wouldn't have any procedural defenses to him seeking to add the counterclaims, meaning if he filed a motion to amend adding additional counterclaims. I don't know of any procedural defense to that.
And what's your theory other than the notes shouldn't have been assigned or VR acted ultra-virus to obtain that assignment? Is there an argument that Paul or Skyline don't owe that money?
Yes, or not owe as much, or that there's an offset. And so the offset is the equitable offset that's been discussed. Prior breach is another issue. And so if you go to paragraph 46 of the complaint in note 1.
Prior breach against the original lender?
Prior breach by this party. So VOR is functioning both as a bad partner and as the new lender, meaning they acquire they step in the shoes of the lender. They are the ones that caused the default. VOR literally caused this default to happen by refusing to renew the security for these notes. Then they acquire the notes, and then they go in and try to enforce them. And so the prior breach is outlined as one of our affirmative defenses in the answer. It's spelled out in the briefing that we did. And then if you read paragraph 46 and note 1, you can see how the facts are engrossed in that. Keep in mind that complaint happens prior to the time that these amendments take place. And so there's no opportunity for me to amend that complaint to adjust it for these facts, because literally the same day that I appeal it is when they do this. And so it's an impossibility. Ships passing in the night. This issue of uncertainty, yes, that would be one of the defenses if there's an uncertain forum. But VOR resolved all uncertainty by taking the step of filing a counterclaim in the name of VOR against Paul and Skyline.
They were really just trying to be extricated, I thought. Maybe. Tell me what you think. Weren't they just trying to be extricated from that lawsuit? And they didn't approve of the effort by the plaintiffs to co-opt the corporate authority or identity of VOR. And it seems like now that VR's not a party, that seems to be what they were really asking for.
So the Skoglund case is perfect for this. The irony is that he brings it up, which is that he created this issue. The Skoglunds created the issue in that case. VOR appears as a party. You can look in the record in 30508. They appear as a party represented by that law firm. They then file an answer wanting to be extricated. Hey, this shouldn't be happening. But then they take the extra step of writing four more paragraphs and say, by the way, VOR now has a counterclaim for tortious interference against Paul and Skyline. Now, what is an affirmative defense to that counterclaim? No, our original relief was valid in the first place, meaning that they've created a counterclaim that incorporates the validity of the entire lawsuit, and then they show up in a different lawsuit and say, oh, by the way, we'd like to collect
them. So claims or counterclaims or whatever can only be animated by the parties that bring them. And if they're no longer a party to that lawsuit on any side of this equation, I don't see how those claims remain. I mean, they may have just wittingly or with knowledge, they took themselves out of that lawsuit.
So if you can find an order that says they're dismissed as a party entirely, then that would be accurate. But there isn't one. It just doesn't exist. They don't dismiss. It doesn't happen. These counterclaims still exist. It's what it is an inaccurate caption. And we don't, under Rule 13A, if you read how that is worded, it doesn't talk about plaintiffs or defendants. It talks about opposing parties. They were an opposing party, and they are still an opposing party. VOR shows up and obtains relief. They literally just, again, this last month, filed for summary judgment again as VOR. They exist as a party. They're in that lawsuit. They created this thing. They didn't have to file a counterclaim in that original lawsuit, but when they chose to, they resolved all uncertainty about that.
Can you respond? So my questions, for Mr. Erickson, related to the what if. So if the summary judgment in favor of VOR were to be affirmed, does that preclude, or in your view, are there still ways in the existing lawsuit that you could somehow assert your equitable relief or set off or damages? I mean, is that, you know, as I understand your position, you're not necessarily asking that the assignment to VOR be unwound, so to speak, but you're entitled to a set off or so is that done then?
So,
and I mean, that's a decision for a court at some later time, but what is your thought on his suggestion that, well, that doesn't cut off your ability to seek that relief?
The irony is that you're literally looking at yourself in the mirror 2 years from now about whether or not these claims still exist. I don't know. You'll have to decide that 2 years from now, or we can just put an end to it right now and say, these claims are out, bring it all in one lawsuit, let's consolidate all of it. To the extent that they're standing, let's go have a trial. If there is no standing, it's over, it's done.
So as I understand what you're saying is, regardless of what we do in this case, we're getting all this these piecemeal appeals, these cases that seem to have issues that overlap with one another. You'd have no opposition if we sent an order back to the circuit court and said consolidate everything.
I had no objection last time, and the only objection I think was from Grand Valley. What happened up below in this case is that Judge Party said at the beginning of the hearing about a month ago that he believed that's what this court wanted him to do, but he didn't do so because nobody had yet asked him, and he wasn't going to consider it that day for us to consolidate it. So this it is a merry-go-round of claims. And to be here 3 years after Victoria Farrell's death and to not have any substantive relief. The rules of civil procedure are a tool of litigation, which is a tool of ethics and morals. We can talk about rules and all of this, but it's designed so that people can go solve problems. That's all we're trying to do in one proceeding that doesn't create problems for people enforcing their rights later. If you affirm this and they begin collections and they take $1 million of Paul's assets, we just had a farm sale of his assets. Paul's estate will owe the money. It will disappear. And 2 years from now, when you affirm that I had the right of $1 million offset and I go to find that money, it's us who will have to explain to Paul's children, Victoria's grandchildren, where the money went. It's that there were overlapping lawsuits and we just let one of them go, and it's just too bad. That's not the result that Rule 1 of civil procedure demands. It's just not. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess.